This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Julia Carpenter, filling in for Shamita Basu. Today, the hidden costs of financial trauma and ways to cope. When Megan McCoy was in college, she was paying her way through school by working as a waitress. One night, she made about $70 in tips. And on her bus ride home, she lost it.
That stunk. Like, it stunk to have to eat ramen or whatever it is. But the amount of self-negative talk that I did afterwards, like how incompetent I am, how I always am messing up with money, how I can never keep a dollar in my pocket, those conversations became embedded in how I saw myself.
It took 15 years for Megan to recognize the huge effect of that small mistake.
Every time someone gave me physical cash, I blew it immediately because the idea of having cash on my body scared me so much that I would end up spending it or putting it somewhere stupid and losing it. And so my behaviors caused a ripple effect that caused more negative behaviors, more times of self-blame and self-destruction.
Megan eventually became a marriage and family therapist, specializing in financial therapy. She's also an assistant professor at Kansas State University. Financial therapy brings together expertise in money and mental health. It emerged after the 2008 financial crisis when millions of people lost jobs, homes, and significant amounts of wealth. These are all things considered financial traumas. But smaller events, like watching our parents fight about money or losing $70 like Megan did, those can be financial traumas too. When we asked you, our listeners, for stories of financial trauma, we heard about many different experiences that have shaped your relationship with money.
I went through a traumatic divorce where finances and child custody were sticking points.
My family lost our home in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis.
I have three kids and I work three jobs.
When I was growing up, my family had a really bad time managing finances, and that probably created some trauma in my life around money.
We'll hear more from those listeners in just a bit. But I started my conversation with Megan by asking what makes financial trauma different from everyday money stress.
I think these are the times in our lives where we really do experience that difference that Brené Brown talks about, like shame versus guilt, right? We all have financial stressors or maybe some guilt around irresponsible behaviors around money. But when it shifts into shame, where you have this negative feeling about who you are in your relationship with money that becomes generalized to other areas of your functioning, that's when it becomes a trauma.
Do you have a sense of how common financial trauma is and who's most commonly affected by it?
It feels something so common to our lives. The APA, the American Psychological Association, always interviews people about their number one stressor. It's been money every year, except for the height of COVID, it was health. And so we interviewed financial planning clients thinking that their rates would be much lower because they tend to skew higher net worth. They have a steward over their financial. Yeah. And the stats were about the same. It was like 72% for general public, 71% for financial planning clients. And so the having money doesn't eradicate the anxiety. Like, even when our needs are met, is a sense of like, when is the other shoe going to drop? Or what is enough? What is that going to even look like for me? I think that can often manifest this way in financial anxiety.
What are the most common stories you hear from folks who have experienced financial trauma?
Yeah, I think they're often about mistakes made when we're young. These are things like wasting, like having that extreme buyer's remorse. I think a lot of it's around home now, like either not buying a home at the right time or buying too expensive a home or not saving. And so there's so many examples of that. Another one is student loan debt, which I think is way too universal nowadays. Like, I end up getting into a lot of student loan debt, and I made decisions about where I worked, what I got to do, the jobs I stuck with, because I blamed myself so much for the student loans that happened 10 years earlier.
You were blaming yourself.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Always about if I was just smarter about money, if I had this magical skill that other people had with money, then I wouldn't have made that mistake. And so I have to deal with the consequences. I have to stay in a job I'm miserable in. Or I always wanted to help people. I have to stay at this job where I don't get to work with the clientele that I can best support because I need the money to pay back my student loans because this is my, like, your penance almost. I think other examples could be more that relational dynamic. Like I remember my mom was amazing and she would sneak us to McDonald's sometimes and she'd be like, don't tell daddy we went to McDonald's, you know, like, aww. And so like it was a loving thing that she did with us, but it also kind of made me as a child who couldn't process what the real meaning of that, like he probably wouldn't have cared that much. But to me, it was like a secret thing. And so that can have its own kind of impact down the road.
It seems like the after effects of financial trauma can end up really harming our finances, but also our actual decision-making around money.
Oh, absolutely. So even more than money impacting our mental health, the opposite is true too. When we're stressed or anxious, that's going to make us manage our money worse. We might overspend to try to cope or things like that. And so there's this bi-directional relationship. A good example is my husband has a lovely family. They were very entrepreneurial and they ended up having to claim bankruptcy. And so my husband had a little bit of time of scarcity. And so now as we're adults and we should be investing, it's harder for him to invest because he wants money in his savings accounts. He wants to be able to sleep at night. And so he might not be making the most optimal investment decisions because of that need to have security from something that happened 30 years ago.
And there's a connection between money and how it impacts our mental health, but also how it impacts our physical health, right?
Oh, yeah. Money has been found to cause ulcers, insomnia, trouble sleeping, like all these physical attributes. In fact, some researchers see financial stress as a carcinogen, meaning that it's actually causing us cancer if we are experiencing sustained financial insecurity.
Wow. I think so much of this just points to how hard it is for us as a culture to talk about money and to talk about the effects of these things.
Yeah.
Are there certain generations that have been disproportionately affected? I was born in 1991, so I'm immediately thinking of 2008, but I also can think of depression babies, for example, other examples of generations that have had this scar.
Yeah, those big global economic impacts. COVID was another one. I think inflation, I think Wall Street issues, all were times where we were shook at our core in a generational way. And what's worse is there's research that shows that generational traumas get passed down, that the stories, the secondhand experiences, or even if you are not secretive, but you don't tell those stories of traumas, they seep through in other ways. Like my grandmother went through the Great Depression. And every time I cut an onion, I hear her yelling at me that you're wasting too much of the onion because she would use the entire thing. And like, I'm like just ripping off the top and getting through it as fast as possible, knowing that I'm probably not going to use the whole thing, you know, that one meal. And so like, even though I'd experienced the Great Depression and she didn't talk about it, those like ripple down effects are felt.
That's so relatable. That's so relatable. Well, I think now we're going to move on to some listener questions. The first listener story we're going to hear from is Jimmy from Grand Rapids. And after, I'm hoping we can talk about your takeaways from Jimmy's story and maybe some advice you would give him.
5 years ago, I went through a traumatic divorce where finances and child custody were sticking points. It lasted over a year with legal fee totaling about $160,000 between my ex-wife and me. I wanted to settle early, but it felt as though the attorneys prolonged the process, causing me a lot of stress and anxiety. This ordeal has profoundly altered my perspective on money. I now consciously choose not to save too much to prevent my assets from becoming a future source of suffering.
Mm. Wow, that is such a clear line between the trauma and the behavior. It's amazing. That is way too long to live in the ambiguity of separation. What we know about divorce is that people are always the most in pain during that period of ambiguity of what is it going to look like, that once the divorce is finalized, happiness levels can go up because then you know what the new life is going to look like.
And the way he says he now sees money as a potential source of suffering, that's so striking.
Oh, yeah. And I think if for listeners who may not have had the same experience, the idea of like, again, the number at the end of the day isn't what's important, but spending with intentionality. Is he burning through his assets in ways that are not aligned with his values? Or is he finding outlets for experiences, for giving to others, for charitable giving that we know makes us happier? Or is it just wasting it? And I hope that even if he doesn't want to acquire assets in the same way, that he can find ways for outlets of using his money today that are more aligned with his values.
I like the way you said that, practicing intentionality in the way we spend our money. The next story is from Harley in LA.
My family lost our home in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. I was a senior in high school, and I remember very vividly walking home from high school and seeing the big foreclosure sign on the gate of our home. This was something that has changed my relationship with money and finances ever since. As I saw my family struggle with finances, I decided I was going to go to college, actually the first in my family to do so. I'm also very interested in personal finance. I listen to personal finance podcasts, and I really keep myself updated on investments and different ways to grow wealth, especially as a woman, and especially not getting those financial lessons growing up in my household. So this moment in high school really shaped me and motivated me to learn as much as I could about finances so that I could avoid finding myself in a similar position as my parents did with our home.
I just love that even though I wish she hadn't gone through such a trauma and at such a formidable age, that she's making like powerful, positive decisions from it. Like there's a great theorist named Naj who talks about how when bad things happen to us in life, we have often two paths. One is destructive entitlement. Like, how dare that happen to me? I'm going to make it happen to other people, or I'm not going to be able to control it, or life is like this. Or there's constructive entitlement where we take what happened to us and we make our lives or the people around us lives better for it, that we learn from it and we grow from it. And so I hope that her foray into financial education ends with her finding peace and a sense of security and not a preoccupation or anxiety around finances.
What's your advice for her on that path, avoiding or not avoiding anxiety, but understanding its impact on her?
Yeah. I love the idea of like, I always get it wrong, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, they have this great saying that is something like, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I think it has biblical reference, a serenity prayer. And I think that saying is such a powerful differential from eustress, like the useful stress that propels us to do the right thing, and it becoming anxiety. And so eustress can be used to say, here's my plan. I have the plan in place. I'm going to be okay. Whereas anxiety comes to this preoccupation and a constant worry that it is going to happen. And so I think having a plan in place and trusting that she has done a great job of becoming an informed consumer and that she'll be okay is really key for anybody who's trying to differentiate normal stress from financial anxiety.
Beautiful. So this next voice message is from Ashley. She lives in Frisco, Texas, and she's someone who seems to be going through a traumatic experience with money right now.
I'm a single mom, and though I've been through some financial hardships in my life, I would definitely say the one that has made the most impact recently has been the inflation. It's very noticeable in every aspect. I have three kids and I work three jobs. I always joke and say I have a job per kid and I don't see myself quitting any of them anytime soon. It definitely hits your pocketbook really in every facet. It's like, not only am I seeing it at the grocery store and in anything I buy or anything my kids want, but also other prices for anybody else that you're purchasing, like their school has gone up, or even at my work, I'm having to raise the prices on people because inflation has gone up for us. So it feels like I'm on both ends of it.
What thoughts would you want to share with someone like Ashley? This is such a relatable story.
Absolutely. And I'm not a big fan about how inflation is being talked about in the media. Sometimes the number that is being presented in some of the media outlets seems like it's not lining up with how we feel at home. And so first, I just want to empathize with any listener who's like, I'm tired of hearing inflation isn't bad because it feels bad, because it does feel bad for many of us. And I just want to express how much I loved her infusion of humor and as she's using that to cope. I think that's the greatest coping skill we can have. I just hope that even though she's doing it all on her own right now, that she does find support. It's not fun having to navigate all the different grant and assistance programs out there, but that is where things like AI could potentially help us, using even ChatGPT to say, what are the different resources I can have as a mom? Maybe I make more of my three jobs to afford Medicaid, but maybe I can be qualified for CHIP, which is a different way of getting health support, or WIC that provides food and healthcare support, or even some of the single mother grants out there around childcare or temporary assistance for families. So I hope she leans on the resources out there to support her. I also think she uses her informal networks of other friends and families and even Facebook support groups to learn. And one other option is that oftentimes financial planners and counselors will offer pro bono services. So even like Googling local financial planning offices that have pro bono to see, can you walk through my budget and see where you could possibly save me money? Or maybe with my taxes, maybe there's childcare tax relief that I didn't think about. And so ways to lean on professionals as well.
This last message is from Alex in Tampa, Florida. He had a near-death experience that seems like it was really a wake-up call for him.
A couple years ago, I was in a pretty bad cycling accident. I was hit by a car and had some pretty traumatic injuries. One of the things that I realized after this accident was that I had never really allowed myself to spend money on things that I wanted. I would always say, oh, I don't need it. I don't need to buy new clothes. I don't need to spend a little bit more money and get a better type of food at the grocery store, right? I would bargain hunt all the time. When I was growing up, my family had a really bad time managing finances and money was always a problem. And that probably created some trauma in my life around money. And so I felt like I always needed to save and hoard money, even though I had done decently for myself and I was in a good position. And so after that accident, if there's something that I know that I can afford and that's something I want, I'm a lot kinder to myself.
What comes to mind when you're thinking about Alex's experience?
Well, anytime someone says they're being kinder to themselves, I am ecstatic. I think we are all too self-critical and that kindness is great. I also believe that moderation is key, that saving too much or spending too much can have harmful consequences to us. But I think spending with intentionality can be beautiful. I love the work by Elizabeth Dunn, who has studied what purchases actually make us happy. And what she found is that like small hedonistic purchases actually make us more happy than big ones. So splurging on that, you know, steak at the grocery store is a great example of a splurge that can feel good. But immediate gratification doesn't make us happy. And so for some of the splurges that this listener or anybody else is doing for themselves, to say, do I need this right now? Or is this something I can create as a goal that I can work towards? So not only do I get the thing at the end of it, but I get this sense of accomplishment, I think could be really powerful. Like, I hate when goals are generic, like, I just want to retire. I just want to fund my kids' college. Like, I wish we did more short-term financial goals that were like also for the less important things in life, but that bring us joy. So instead of buying, I don't know, the newest jacket or something, saying in 6 months, I'm going to save up that amount in the special account that's named jacket and buying that jacket and being like, heck yeah, I did that. So you get that secondary pleasure of the jacket and I did that kind of feeling.
And then maybe you're buying the jacket on sale. Maybe waiting was really great.
Yeah. Purchasing isn't what's going to make us happy. It's things like experiences. It's things that bring enjoyment to the people around us in our lives. And so if the emphasis isn't on materialistic objects, but objects that bring us joy because of the experiences we have from it, I think it can be beautiful.
Having listened to these four callers now, I wanted to ask you about other coping mechanisms for folks going through traumatic experiences with money right now.
One of the big ones, at least it was for me, was separating financial decisions from who I am as a person. Like, I have little girls.
Wow.
I have little girls now, and they probably hate that I harp on this, like the momisms that we all have. But whenever they say, I am something, I'm like, no, you don't boil down to one thing. Change how you say that. And it's like a simple like language thing they think right now. But I'm hoping eventually that they never use language like I'm dumb or I'm incompetent or I can't do that, because we are too multidimensional. So if your financial traumas have resulted in you feeling like you are something, I am something, that's the first thing that shifts, because everyone is beautiful. Everyone has their skills, their weaknesses, and luckily we can lean on those around us who have the strengths where we have weaknesses and vice versa.
I interview so many people who say, I am irresponsible, I am unlucky, I am bad with money.
So can I tell you, there's a nerdy, I am unlucky story that I found the other day. They did this experiment where they said something like, the person who finds the first five, let's say, dollar signs in this massive find picture, you know, like when this Where's Waldo kind of pictures, gets to win $100, right? And then they've separated the groups into I am lucky or I am unlucky. And very small in the document, it said, there's only four dollar signs in this, right? And all the lucky people found that first. Whereas all the unlucky people had this self-predicting prophecy that they were just too unlucky to find the fifth symbol. So like, everybody should stop saying they're unlucky, because we make our own luck. We make our own future.
Wow. I also want to talk about a few other examples that might come up when we think about financial trauma. One of those is financial infidelity. And I know you work a lot with couples. What can some of the impacts of financial infidelity be? And how do you help a couple or an individual work through that?
Oh, I love financial infidelity. And I see it so much more broadly than some people do. Like, clearly, financial infidelity is lying about money, lying about how much you make or how much you have or how much debt you have. But there's these smaller indiscretions we do about money. Like, I joked about my mom saying, don't tell daddy about going to McDonald's. That could be an example of a small financial infidelity or small lack of financial transparency. And those smaller indiscretions often are the canary in the coal mine. They are the signs that maybe you're having some shame around your spending behaviors, or maybe you don't feel like you have enough power to ask for what you want in life, or maybe that your partner isn't listening to you. So I love helping couples see the financial infidelity as a sign of something in their relationship that they can transform and become better from. And of course, there are more insidious things. Sometimes financial infidelity is addiction. Sometimes financial infidelity is actually a physical infidelity. And when it's those times, that larger issue also has to get resolved before the financial infidelity can get touched on. But regardless, financial infidelity erodes the trust in a relationship. It erodes the sense of like, my future is going to look like X. It makes you doubt almost everything, and that can be really scary.
How do you rebuild that trust after something like that happens? Repairing the relationship after a scar like that?
Right. I think first step is the partner who did the financial infidelity has to hold themselves accountable, has to express their remorse, has to make amends, and then has to figure out the origin of that financial infidelity, why it happened, so it doesn't happen again, and creating a plan for transparency. And that I never like victim blaming, but I think it also takes the person where the infidelity occurred to become literate. Like, I am money avoidant despite talking about it every day. Like, when I was younger, I did not like money. I did not want to talk about money. I did not want to think about money. It made me anxious. And it took a lot of work to put my hand to the fire of saying, I need to look at my accounts. I need to know what my financial situation is. I need to do the work to become financial literate and a financial partner to be able to take some of the load off of them and to understand what our financial situation is. So I think both things have to happen.
Our episode last week was with a journalist named Charlotte Coles. She wrote this incredible piece for The Cut about how she lost $50,000 in a scam. Can you talk about the emotional impact of being scammed? How do you recover going forward?
Oh, gosh. It goes back to this Renew plan. It is about thinking about how can I make a list of how I'm going to get my finances back in situation, I'm in this situation. How am I going to pay off the debt in the right order? How am I going to make a little more than I spend? I use a lot of bucketing strategies for myself because it's hard for me. I think it's hard for many of us to manage larger amounts of money. And so my paycheck doesn't go to one account. It goes to multiple accounts. It goes to an account for rainy day, account for future vacations, account for debt, account for fun money. And so that's how I'm able to manage it. And so maybe the fun money needs to get smaller. So you open your account and you're like, oh gosh, I'm not going to eat out tonight. And those kind of things to kind of trick yourself into doing the right thing. I think also there's a great exercise in therapy called the worry hour, where if you find yourself kind of ruminating about your finances a lot, you have to require a 1 hour a day period where you're like, okay, this is when I'm going to delegate all my worries to. And every time you start noticing yourself drifting into that cycle of ruminations, you have to say, break, I'm going to wait till I do that. And then during the worry hour, you really find a way to let all your worries out, the most extreme concerns you have about your finances, whether it's writing it down, which is what I prefer, or some people speak it onto like an audio recording. And what you notice is it's very hard for us to fill a whole hour, which is always a little bit of like a secondary benefit to be like, oh, I only filled up 30 minutes of my worry hour today. Like I'm doing better. But also it can help you, again, separate what do I have control over and what can I make a plan like constructively to tackle those things I have control over and what do I not have control over. And those are the things that we use emotional coping strategies like meditation, mindfulness, walking, going out with friends to kind of distract ourselves from.
The last topic I wanted to talk about with you is debt. This is another thing that brings with it so much shame, so much guilt. It can feel like an actual weight, a real weight on a person's life. How do you help people emotionally when they are managing having a lot of debt?
Yeah, it's very, very hard because I think that if you worry about too much about your debt, you do this like a restrict binge cycle around spending where it's so much on the top of your mind, you're restricting yourself so tremendously that you end up blowing it in other areas because you think of the 200 times you restricted yourself from the vending machine or the coffee or the little things, then you blow it all on like a night out with your friends. And so I think with debt, I think it's breaking it down. Like this is going to sound like a tangent, but I promise I'll come back. But I was in $100,000 in student loan debt. And I finally paid it off last year after a lot of work. And it was really exciting for like a day. And then I started thinking about it less and less. And unless I'm in a situation where to bring it up, I don't even think about the joy I experienced at moments of paying it off because I had one number to pay off. I wish if I could go back in time, I would have said, hey, this year, your goal is to pay off 8,000 of it and had spent time celebrating that 8,000. Next year, let's do 12 and celebrate it. And so then I would have had more moments of success, more moments of progress, more moments of celebrations instead of waiting all the way to the end. So do I think everybody can tackle their debt tomorrow? No. But if we make it smaller and tangible and have milestones accomplished, like you'll have a sense of delayed happiness or extended happiness that'll benefit us.
Are there any other just general pieces of advice or counseling that you give to people with financial trauma?
One of the big ones is that I believe a lot of times financial traumas have someone else's voice attached to it. Like whose voice do you hear barraging along with your own? Like who are you thinking about when you're like, gosh, I'm stupid. I wish I had listened to so-and-so's advice or I hear my mother saying I should have done this or those things. And so kind of like broadening out like what else is getting tied into the trauma. Like is it other times that you were incompetent that you worry about someone's judgment or other times you feel like you failed someone? I think unpacking that can be really beneficial. Because I think trauma kind of acts like one of those like bug traps, like you get sticky. And so other traumas start to get added onto it. And so unpacking that can be really powerful.
And in closing, I wanted to talk about support for others. Do you have advice for folks who have a loved one who's experienced a financial trauma, a parent, a sibling, a partner? What are some ways to support these people in our lives?
Oh, I love that. I wish we could be more open with each other about our traumas. I wish we were more curious about people's negative behaviors, even like for instance, say my husband having that experience early in life around financial insecurity, is it probably is more of a saver than I would be. And it's really easy to watch him say, oh, we spent too much, and internalize that as he's telling me I spent too much, or he is always right. So cheap, or doing all these like assumptions about what we're thinking. And instead, giving them the benefit of doubt and say, what's going on for you? Like, I see a strong reaction. I want to know more about you. I want to understand where this is coming from. I think being able to speak about our financial traumas makes them have less power, helps people say, oh, I've been through that too, and I've gotten through it. I think it gives us optimism. And I just think it gives us a sense of it's going to be okay. They're okay because they went through a trauma, and I'll be okay too.
Incredible. Incredible. Thank you, Megan, so much. Thank you for all of your insight and for making the time.
Oh, good. It's so nice seeing you all.
I know we're going to talk again soon.
I hope so.
Absolutely. We've selected a couple of articles that offer more advice on how to cope with financial trauma. You can find those on our show notes page. And if you're enjoying this show, Apple News and Conversation, please rate and review us in Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find the show.